Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. As she was stepping down from the post of chair of the National Labor Relations Board last August, Wilma Liebman said this. She said that she couldn't recall a time when the very idea of collective bargaining was so divisive in American politics. At the same time, she said, all of this controversy was a good thing because it got people thinking about the importance of the issue. Well, this morning in this hour of Focus, we will be spending some time talking with two guests. One of them is Wilma Liebman. We'll be talking about the National Labor Relations Board, and I think that there are probably a lot of people who aren't really sure what it is or what it does, so we'll be talking about that. But we'll also be talking about the right of workers to organize and why it is that it seems at this point it's such a crucial and controversial issue. So joining us here in the studio, we have Joel Kutcher-Kirchenfeld. He's Dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois, and he's been with us before. We're pleased to have him. And joining us by telephone, Wilma Liebman. And just a couple of things about her. She was appointed as a member of the National Labor Relations Board by President Bill Clinton in 1997. She was reappointed twice by President George W. Bush, and then President Obama, when he came into office, he designated her to be the chair of the NLRB, only the second woman to hold that job in all of the history, 78-year history of the board. She stepped down as the chair and as member of the board when her term expired this past August of 2011. She was here to give a talk, actually, on the campus in early December, and we wanted to have her on the program, but unfortunately all the planets weren't properly aligned, and that didn't happen, but we're very pleased that she could be with us, joining us by telephone. And Ms. Liebman, hello.
Good morning. Hello.
Thanks for your time. And Joel, thank you.
Pleasure to be here, David.
And let me also just say real quick for people who are listening, questions and comments are welcome, as always. We hope people can be brief, but questions are welcome. If you want to call in the number for Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I think, Ms. Liebman, you know, I lifted those that quote there from you from an article that was on the Huffington Post, and this was an article that was mentioned what you were thinking about as you were getting ready to step down from the board. And I thought it was a very striking quote, and I think it says a lot about where we are now. Maybe one way to start is just to have you talk a little bit about why you think perhaps it is that now at this point, and has been true for the last number of months, labor issues and questions of labor law have indeed been the subject of such a hot debate.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you, David, for having me here. Pleasure to be here with you and Joel. I think you raise a very good question. The NLRB is no stranger to controversy. This law has been the subject of deeply held and divided views almost from the beginning. The law was first passed in 1935 in the middle of the Great Depression. But notwithstanding that, the events of certainly the last year or so have been quite exceptional and exceptionally rancorous. I think the reasons are that we are in the middle of an economic crisis once again, and that this crisis has really stirred up exposed the national fault lines over issues of labor law. The crisis has created fiscal constraints that in turn has led to partisan arguments against worker rights and benefits and has inflamed societal conflict. We've seen that in the states, in Wisconsin and Ohio, and here in Capitol Hill regarding federal labor law. So that's one. I think it's just the situation that we are in has aggravated and exposed these fault lines. The board has also, I would say, come back to life in the last year and a half. It had been neutered for a long time. And the beginnings of the stirrings of life again, I think, have enraged some in the legal and business community. And, of course, it's become part of presidential election politics. So I think that further stirs things up. And then the whole issue of inequality has become a national issue again. I think the Occupy movement has opened up that dialogue. And this law really is all about inequality. If you look at the express language of the statute, why it was enacted to address inequality in bargaining power between workers and their employers, and to do that through the institution of collective bargaining, and with the ultimate goal of increasing workers' purchasing power. And that purpose was to restore the nation to economic prosperity. Again, it was the middle of the Depression. I think this expressed purpose resonates in the economic environment we live in today. I think it's the multiple reasons why these issues have come back in the news and in such a controversial way.
Yeah. Just real quick also to pick up on the other part of the quote that I stole and used it to try to promote the program, that it's certainly the issue of organizing and bargaining, to organize for workers and collective bargaining, has been heated now here just recently, particularly when it applies to public employees, the conflict that we saw in the state of Wisconsin. We also saw it in the state of Ohio. We've talked about it here on this program more than once. And it seems to be something that has actually gotten people, whether they are involved in unions or not, thinking about whether or not those rights are important and they should be preserved. So just to take the other point that you made in this HuffPost piece, you think that it's actually a good thing that people are not talking about this and perhaps asking themselves, well, are these rights important to preserve or not?
Absolutely. I think that I think it's unfortunate that the issues are so divisive and so rancorous. But the silver lining really is that people's awareness about these basic rights and the role of collective bargaining is being increased, and increased awareness, I think, is always good. Perhaps it will lead to further understanding and maybe even to a more serious dialogue, which we really need to have in our society, very serious dialogue, not just a politically polarized dialogue with a lot of rhetoric.
Sure. I think
so that's the hope.
I think Joel wants to pick up on that.
Well, I think the increased public awareness can be put in context. I actually have a quote that I'd like to read. It's a long quote, and it's a bit of a quiz for the listeners. I'll give you the answer when I'm done. But the question is, which American president said this? Mm-hmm. The quote says, "We have a strong labor movement in this country, a free labor movement. And if someone were to come to the scene today, he would think that the labor movement had been part of the American tradition from the beginning. However, any student of American history knows this is not the case. There was no free trade union movement of any strength in young America, not even in Lincoln's America, not even in the late 19th century. There were labor unions, but they had to fight all the way for recognition not only in bargaining with management, but recognition in terms of their relations with government. As a matter of fact, as far as the labor movement in the United States was concerned, it wasn't until the 1930s when the Wagner Act was passed, as Wilma mentioned, at the highest levels in our government that bargaining was recognized in the U.S. The AFL-CIO, from the dues of its members in this country, helps free labor unions around the world. They have groups in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and Europe, and they do this for two reasons. One, they have a bond of brotherhood with people, working people all over the world. But second, they do it for another reason, because the leaders of the free trade union movement are devoted to the survival of freedom and the growth of freedom around the world. I'm going to make a statement that is tremendously important, and I trust all of you will remember this from here on. When we think of dictatorship and we think of free trade union movements, the two cannot exist together. There's no country in the world today in which there is a dictator in which there is also a free trade union movement. And there is no country in the world today which has free trade union movement that has a dictator. As we see it, a strong, vigorous free trade union movement is essential if we're going to have free governments in this country or in the world." Mm-hmm. Now, the question was, of course, which American president said that? And you might be surprised to know that it was Richard Nixon in 1972. And it really reflects the point in time in which the trade union movement in this country had reached its peak and had really been responsible for building a middle class and had provided check and balance against capitalism and had been an engine for growth in the economy. And so the contrast between that and today, when people are saying unions are no longer needed, is quite stark. Mm-hmm.
I guess, though, I'll turn back to Ms. Liebman, and in a sense, I'm asking the same question again. But, you know, given where we are now, I think with the attitudes a lot of people have in regards to organized labor and the fact that the percentage of the American population that is involved in a union has shrunk considerably from the high point. You said it was a good thing that we're not talking about these issues, but I guess I keep coming back to the question, well, how many people truly feel that the right to organize, to bargain collectively, that there are some kind of, that there's a system that workers can use to pursue their grievances in a peaceful and orderly and organized manner. You know, how many people really think that that's an important thing, that all of those things exist?
Well, I think it's a great secret that this law applies across the private sector. It's not just a law that applies in a unionized workplace. Mm-hmm. And I think because of the decline of organized labor over the last few decades, fewer people really know what these rights are. Fewer know that they have them. Fewer know that the contribution was of organized labor to our economy and to our democracy. And yet, I think when they learn about them, people like their rights. They want to hold on to the rights. I think that was demonstrated in what happened in Ohio. And I think all the noise, all the controversy shows that labor law still matters to people. I think people instinctively go to each other to try to improve their terms and conditions of employment. I think solidarity is part of who we are. Democracy in the workplace is, I think, still basic to a democratic society. Collective bargaining, I think people realize, is still basic to a fair economy. All the issues of inequality are very much in the public eye today. And it matters because clearly the issues that divide labor and capital are always going to be with us in some form and some degree. And labor law provides a system of governance as opposed to just anarchy or violence to resolve the disputes that arise between labor and capital. It provides access to economic justice at the workplace. As Joel said, it made a huge contribution to the expansion of the middle class in this country. And the collective bargaining system really allows labor and business to reach their own solutions in response to changing economic conditions. It's based on a system of voluntarism, not government mandates. And in that sense, I would think, it's always mystified me, why business is not more pro-collective bargaining.
Another thing on that point, David, is that when American workers are surveyed, actually a much larger proportion of them indicate a preference to have a union than are unionized because they don't fall into neat clumps of 50% plus one workers in any given workplace. But more important than that, when workers are asked, would you like to be part of an organization that would protect you against unfair treatment and bargain on your behalf to help improve wages, hours, and working conditions, the vast majority of workers say yes. And so there's also an issue here. Unions have some work to do, both to improve their image and to improve the reality to match the needs of today's workplace. And employers have been vigorous in their attempts to undermine unions and create power advantage. But the bottom line is that the principle of having a voice is something that the vast majority of American workers desire.
I think, just to point out that in the cases we had before the NLRB, we often would see situations where workers would come together to try to improve their lives on the job. Sometimes they had a union to help them. Sometimes they just acted on their own. But that kind of coming together, as I said, it seems pretty instinctive. With respect to unionization, sometimes they are fearful because of employer resistance.
Let me take a moment here to introduce again our guest for anybody who has just tuned in. Joining us by telephone is Wilma Liebman. She is a former chair of the National Labor Relations Board. She served on the board for a number of years. When Barack Obama became president, he designated her to be the chair of the board. She stepped down as a member and as chair when her term expired in the end of August of this past year, August of 2011. Joining us here also in studio, Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld. He's the dean and also professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about the NLRB and about the importance of labor law, the role of collective bargaining in a civil society. Questions, comments are welcome. I have three people here all lined up and ready to go. We'll get to them in just a second. I guess I'm just curious very quickly. I wanted to ask Wilma Liebman, why, when when your term expired, I believe that, as if I understand this right, you asked not to be reappointed to the board. Why, at that point, did you decide that you had done it with the board and didn't want to continue?
Well, I've been on the board for close to 14 years, which is an unusually long tenure in recent times. Only two people had longer terms than I, one 25 years, one 20, and those were decades ago. So I felt that I had come to the point where I wanted to move on.
Fair enough. I just wanted to ask the question. Well, we have some other callers here, and let's talk with them. We'll start with line number one. This is someone in Champaign right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd just like to ask about a simple point of fact. Are there any service industry employers in the United States who have successfully unionized in the, say, past 30 years? The support staff of a law firm or a privately held hospital or a software company or anything in the so-called new economy. I have never heard of one actually carrying out an organizing drive successfully, but then there are lots of things I haven't heard of. So I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. I don't know who wants to start.
Let me take a first stab.
Okay, sure.
There's been lots of successful organizing in service industries. One of the really fertile grounds for organizing is in hospitals or nursing homes. Not every organizing drive is successful, but many have been. Janitors. The Service Employees International Union has organized thousands of janitors in many cities across the country. Just naming a couple, but there are certainly other service industries that, yes, have been successfully organized.
And if I might build on that, one of the largest organized healthcare organizations is the Kaiser Permanente chain, which is not as well known perhaps to listeners in this area, but covers about 13 states in the western part of the country and accounts for over 100,000 unionized workers. And what's important about that case is that the 17 unions covering many, many bargaining units have formed all, I think, but one of them, the California Nurses, have formed a strategic partnership with Kaiser Permanente focused not just on collective bargaining about wages, hours, and working conditions, but also on improving patient care. Even addressing almost undiscussable issues such as surfacing and addressing medical errors. And so as a joint union management partnership, both management and the union would say that they've done things that neither of them could do separately. So actually the service sector is an area where unions as professional organizations representing professionals are pushing the frontiers of forms of representation.
I just wanted to mention, I'm virtually certain that in Illinois, as in California, thousands of home health care aides have been organized.
So these new kind of forms of representation begin to address the changing nature of work itself. You know, when unions first organized, work was craft-based, and you had unions that were organized around crafts, and we still see that in construction with sheet metal workers and carpenters, electricians, and so on. When the Industrial Revolution came, the industrial model emerged, and unions were organized by industry, auto, steel, and so on. Today, people point to the role of knowledge-driven work and the need for, in a sense, professional representation around knowledge and skills. And so those forms are still emerging.
One thing I might add is one of the difficulties that has emerged is as the economy has become more competitive, employers have looked for more flexible employment arrangements. So the old, stable, secure employment relationship that lasted a lifetime is more and more becoming a thing of the past, and employers are looking for either leased employees, contract labor, contingent employment. And under the law and the definitions of who's covered by the law, the definition of an employee, the exclusion of independent contractors, there is an increasing issue of whether workers in these new employment arrangements are actually covered by the law, and that's one of the legal issues that remains very vexing and is frequently litigated.
All right, let's talk with another caller. This is also someone in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to raise the issue of public worker or government worker labor unions and have your guests discuss the what I often hear about is the conflict of interest between the government, in a sense, negotiating with its workers and at the same time being subject to lobbying and all the corrupt political practices, examples of which we have in Illinois, of the government officials receiving donations, et cetera, from union officials and some of the legal problems we've had with the various governors in the state of Illinois, et cetera. So I wonder if you could talk about the general themes of both on the federal level, where I gather it's illegal for federal employees to unionize, and the state level and all the back and forth about that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Joel?
Joel, let me let you take the lead with the,
that's fine.
The state level. No. Let me just say, I believe the caller said it's illegal in the federal sector, but that is, in fact, not the case. Federal employees do have the right to organize and bargain collectively. There have been a few excluded areas, mostly having to do with national security, but in general, employees in the federal sector do have the right. They are governed by a separate government agency called the Federal Labor Relations Authority.
And in fact, the TSA, which was previously excluded recently, was granted collective bargaining rights.
And the employees voted for a union.
Yeah. And even on the security, there are quite a few military bases where the workers loading nuclear munitions on planes are unionized, and it really hasn't proved to be a threat to our national security. But to get to the core question that the caller asked, it was really a question, do unions have undue influence in the public sector on public officials? When public sector unions first started organizing in the 60s and in the 70s, there was a great debate on this. And let me just say, in the private sector, the whole notion of workers having a right to unionize originally was carved out from the property rights of an employer. And in a sense, there have since been UN declarations of human rights that said the right to organize and the right to free speech and so on are basic human rights. But initially, it was a question of the owner of the business, in effect, owning the workforce. And then that had to be carved out as not necessarily just a property right. In the public sector, it's a little different because it's not as though we have owners of the business. It's the taxpayers themselves. That debate was heated in the early years, and it really settled down when there became very clear evidence and quite a bit of research to suggest that the fears of unions having undue influence over public officials were overblown, that, in fact, there were many pulls and tugs on public officials. The unions were one. But it has come back in full force in recent years with the attacks on public sector collective bargaining. There's an interesting reverse side to it. There was a Supreme Court case called Citizens United, which gave both employers and unions and other organizations much more ability to make donations to political campaigns. And many observers believe that the attacks on public sector collective bargaining have had more to do with people wanting to undermine the Democratic Party to get political advantage in elections, which is almost the reverse kind of influence, that attacks on unions aren't really about attacks on collective bargaining. They're attacks to weaken the Democratic Party, which is often supported by unions, which I would view as just as much of a concern. At the end of the day, we live in a pluralistic society, and there's a balance that you have to strike. Do you want people to have the right to bargain collectively? And if it's in the public sector, does that create an undue political problem? The evidence, by the way, has been, for the most part, no. Now, I will make one final comment, which is that I believe that parties in both the public and private sector do have a responsibility to worry about what we call public goods. So if people worry that teachers are being protected who are bad teachers by collective bargaining agreements, well, unions have a responsibility to step up and say, no, we have to have standards so that children aren't harmed by virtue of a collective bargaining agreement. And by the way, literally hundreds of unions have negotiated language focusing on educational outcomes, teacher performance, and other matters. But I think there's more work to be done to attend to what we might call the public goods that are at stake when unions and managements negotiate.
Okay. Let's, again, take another caller. This is also someone in Champaign. Line number three. Hello.
Yes. I was, excuse me, I was very happy to hear the quote from Richard Nixon. Very interesting. And my question is related to your most recent answer to the previous caller, which has to do with the political situation. One thing that really concerns me but fascinates me as well is the fact that Mitt Romney is, of course, the leading Republican candidate, the so-called moderate among the bunch. And, of course, he is the one that Newt Gingrich and others have accused of being a vulture capitalist and so forth. And I was surprised, actually, to see the New York Times cover on a Sunday about 3 weeks ago, I think it was, in which they went into great detail demonstrating, at least seemed to me at least, that Bain Capital, I guess it was perhaps the first major vulture company in recent U.S. history, major company. And so I was fascinated by that, but I'm also fearful in a sense of a Mitt Romney presidency, given his history of being anti-union and so forth. And I'm curious what you think of what the possibilities would be in such a case for the National Union Relations Board and so forth. Anyway, I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know, Ms. Lieben, you want to comment on that?
Well, let me say that it's very discouraging to me that when President Obama made recess appointments to the NLRB about a week or so ago to prevent the board from going down to just two of its five members and therefore not being able to function, he made three recess appointments, and Mitt Romney immediately called the recess appointments invalid and referred to them as union stooges. Oddly enough, the three included one Republican nominee who was previously the chief counsel to a person who is now the labor advisor to Mitt Romney. So it's kind of odd that he would be called a union stooge too. But putting that aside, it's disappointing that the rhetoric really is so crass about what's going on. These are serious issues. And to reduce everything to this kind of rhetoric and outworn kind of prejudices, I think is very disappointing and lacking. It's hard to predict what a Mitt Romney NLRB would look like. I think there's reason to believe it would look pretty much like what the NLRB looked like under President Bush. And that was a time, really, when the decisions were all deeply divided along party lines. We disagreed about what the law is, what the law should be, about policy preferences, about legal methodology. They tended to look at the statute as static, stuck basically in 1935 or 1947 terms. They didn't at all make an effort to look at the real-world consequences of what they were doing. They claimed that that would be improper, that that was results-oriented. In case after case, they elevated property rights over worker rights. They elevated employers' free speech rights over workers' rights. And not that these balancing and countervailing considerations don't have to be taken into account, but when in every policy choice workers' rights are subordinated, something's wrong under this statute. So I think there is cause for concern for workers' rights, for the institution of collective bargaining, if we were to go back to that approach, and I think there's reason to suspect we would.
And by the way, I might note that Wilma wrote what's now a fairly famous or infamous set of dissents during that period, which actually together outline a very coherent view of the set of labor policies that better correspond to today's realities. But let me push a little harder on a part of the caller's question, which is what some people have called the financialization of our markets and our society. We have developed very good ways to understand the interplay between labor markets and capital markets. And the NLRB, of course, sits at that intersection, as Wilma suggests in her comments. And we do understand that labor is what economists call a derived demand. The demand is for goods, and then you have a demand for labor to go with it, and the two play off each other. The recent economic collapse threw into sharp relief a third kind of market, financial markets, which really play by different rules. And there are financial investors, by the way, who really do worry about creating sustainable investments in society. So not all of venture capital should be painted with one brush. But there is quite a track record of folks who make investments, take out loans, pay themselves, leverage the investments, and leave the firms worse off if they exist at all afterwards. And there isn't good check and balance in our society on that.
We're talking this morning in this hour of focus about the National Labor Relations Board, about labor law, the role of collective bargaining in a civil society. We will continue to talk in just a moment. We need to take a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from the Illinois Chamber Orchestra in their scintillating and sophisticated concert with violinist Karina Kanellakis in Vivaldi's Four Seasons with guest conductor Andrew Sewell on Friday, January 20th at St. Agnes Church in Springfield and Saturday, the 21st at Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington. Information at ilsymphony.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, for the benefit of anybody who wants to be more organized in the new year, we have two guests who have written a book that's titled Organize Your Mind and Your Life, Train Your Brain to Get More Done in Less Time. Paul Hammernes, he is a psychiatrist at the Harvard Med School, and also Margaret Moore, co-director of the Institute of Coaching at McLean Hospital, and also founder and CEO of Well Coaches Corporation. So they'll have some suggestions on how you can get your mind in order in the new year. And then also tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, we'll do our monthly show on personal finance. Kevin Waspy will be the guest this time around. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I. So basic questions people have about their own financial planning matters, give us a call. That's tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings 10 until noon. We've got 10 different topics for you every week. We always welcome your questions, comments. You can check the schedule, listen to past programs by going to our website, and that is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour focus, we have two guests here in the studio with me is Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld. He is Dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, has been with us before to have some talk about various subjects that have to do with labor. And then joining us by phone is Wilma Liebman. She is the former chair of the National Labor Relations Board. She was appointed to the board by President Bill Clinton in the fall of 1997. She was twice reappointed by President George W. Bush, and then President Obama named her to be the chair, and she served until her term expired in August of last year. And she's joining us by phone. The number here, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. I do have an email question here I want to make sure that I get in. And the listener writes this: I've been a close observer of the NLRB's work for many years and strongly support the rights given to workers by the National Labor Relations Act. Lately, however, I'm beginning to wonder if the board itself, that is the five-member board, not the entire agency, is more trouble than it's worth. What would be the effect of eliminating the board, transferring its duties and employees to the U.S. Department of Labor, and allowing the direct appeal of administrative law judge decisions to the federal courts? How about that, Ms. Liebman?
Something close to that has, in fact, been proposed by a South Carolina Republican member of Congress who was very angry about the complaint that the agency's acting general counsel brought against the Boeing company. And so he's proposed legislation that would transfer part of the board's jurisdiction to the Department of Justice and part to the Department of Labor. I think that the reason for the board being the way it is a function of the notions that really came out of the New Deal period. Felix Frankfurter championed the idea of an administrative agency with expertise and a dedicated cadre of employees who would be impartial and an expert. Certainly there are problems and issues that the administrative agency model does create. Number one, delays. Delays are famous and exacerbated, really, by the whole appointment controversy of board members. And I think that the debate is certainly one worth having. It's been discussed at various times over the decades, whether this is the best model. I don't really want to weigh in on which I think is better. I think there are arguments pro and con all the different models. I wouldn't say that the board itself is, I forget what the questioner asked, more trouble than it's worth. I wouldn't say it's more trouble than it's worth. I think that the appointment process, which has become so politicized, is counterproductive. And if there were a way to depoliticize in some fashion, that would certainly be constructive.
Okay. Here's another email, and this is something that I did want to try to get into. I'm glad someone has raised it. Someone writes that notes that their former home, state of Indiana, next door, is currently attempting to pass right-to-work legislation. And the guest, or the caller is wondering, the listener is wondering, whether you have any comment to make on how a right-to-work legislation may have some logic from a financial or economic point of view. Can you argue it has anything like a positive effect on relations between workers and employers or the economic health of a state? And they're also interested in how right-to-work legislation might play out with federal contracts. And I'm particularly interested in the basic question, you know, can you make an argument that there is any benefit to that kind of legislation?
Economically, I don't think that the data reflects that right-to-work legislation has a positive economic benefit in the state. I don't think the facts show that. For a union itself, it's the difficulty of trying to spend money to organize a workforce and the difficulties of representing what are so-called free riders, those who choose not to financially support the union. So there's maybe a disincentive for a union to embark on expensive organizing efforts and representation efforts. So in my way of thinking, there is no correlation between right-to-work legislation, either on a state level or federal level, and economic prosperity.
I'd also like to draw a contrast between the debate over issues like right-to-work in this country and what we see happening around the world. If you go to Australia, for example, they had a very robust but, I'll call it, stodgy set of labor laws for industry-level bargaining. They had a Republican, what we would be equivalent to our Republican government, come in, a more conservative party that tried to move to individual contracts between employers and employees. And that, too, swung the pendulum way far the other way. And that's been thrown out. And the new government has come in and passed legislation called Fair Work Australia, which really has two goals. One is to help Australian enterprises succeed in the global economy and at the same time provide fair treatment in the workplace. And that kind of dual mission of high performance but good jobs or fair treatment is something that a number of nations are looking to find, that high road, and using legislative means to try to promote this notion of high-performance work systems where workers have representation and rights. And it's a case in which those nations that are trying to find that path are having some success and economically. And so for us to be caught in a debate over which rights to take away really misses the point about how do we grow this economy to have both good jobs and fair treatment.
Well, is it possible? I wonder what some people would make the argument on the one hand that employers should not be able to throw up roadblocks to make it difficult for people who are attempting to organize workers. At the same time, shouldn't that be a matter that people join unions because they freely choose to, that they're not compelled to, and that they're doing it because they think that there's an advantage for them to do that? Can you really steer a course between those, maybe those admittedly are extreme positions, but can you steer a course between them? Ms. Liebman?
Yeah, I missed the steer a course between extremes.
Between on the one hand saying that there should be that workplaces should be free and open to organizing, and at the same time that workers shouldn't feel compelled to have to join the union in order to have a job.
Well, that of course is the goal of what the board attempts to do. We try to enforce the law in a way to enable what is been historically called laboratory conditions for an election, so that employees can freely exercise their rights to choose or to refrain from unionization, but in an atmosphere free of intimidation, coercion, threats, discharges, etc. Sometimes that's not always so easy, because if employers are intent on keeping a union out of the workplace, they will often study board decisions and figure out just how far they can go and what they say and what they do, just almost up to the line. Sometimes they cross the line. Some of them think it's maybe a good investment, even if they are found to have broken the law in what they say or do, because it ultimately kills the organizing drive. Some of them, as I said, stay within the law, but still might engage in conduct which would kind of discourage employees. They may become fearful even if the employer is not specifically violating the law. So that's what the goal of the law is. Enforcing it in that way is sometimes a challenge. The long organizing campaigns that go on sometimes will have the effect of diminishing employee support for unionization. The board's remedies are pretty weak, so it's hard really to discourage an employer who is really hell-bent on keeping a union out. So, you know, most employers do abide by the law, but the process itself may not be ideal for the free expression of employee rights.
We just have about 10 minutes left. I have a couple of callers. I want to try to get them. And again, for people who have tuned in, I want to very quickly introduce the guests. Wilma Liebman, she is the former chair of the National Labor Relations Board. Served on the board for a number of years as a member, and then was appointed by President Obama to was named to be the chair by the president, and then she stepped down when her term expired last August. Here in studio with me, Joel Kutcher-Gershenfeld. He's the dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We have two other callers here. We'll try to get them both. Next, let's talk with someone in Savoy on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Finally. Given the goings-on in Wisconsin, Ohio, et cetera, I have been thinking, and it seems to me that we should have a class of employees that have a right to collective bargaining but no right to strike, such as school teachers, snow removal people, police, firemen. Is this not so, or has some manipulative and or nonsensical group of people written the law to preclude such?
Actually, for essential service employees in most states where they are unionized, they have what's called mandatory or binding arbitration and no right to strike. So police and fire employees in particular fall in that category. In some cases, that's true for teachers. In some cases, it's not. The reality is that strikes have gone down. They're much less common than they used to be. And as an economic weapon. But the caller makes an important point that, you know, when a strike happens with essential service employees, there are public goods that are on the table that are at risk. And various mechanisms where, in effect, a third-party arbitrator is asked to hear both sides and make a decision, sometimes issue by issue, sometimes on the whole package, those models have worked.
What has to occur legally to set it that way in motion?
Well, it goes back to the structure of the law. Each state has different forms of legislation, so there's quite a bit of variation state by state. But as I said, in most states where police and fire workers have the right to bargain, they do not have the right to strike.
Do you think we're getting told the entire picture about what's going on in Wisconsin, or is there some slipshoddiness in the reporting?
Well, there's been a lot of reporting, and some of it accurate, some of it not. Much has been made about the claim that public sector workers are overpaid, but there have been quite a few definitive studies that have done apples-to-apples comparisons, holding education constant, and in fact, average wages for public sector workers in Wisconsin are about 7% less than private sector workers, and it's true in a number of states. When you take into account benefits, it's about 3% less, so there's somewhat higher benefits. But, you know, to come back all full circle to the inequality issues that Wilma Lieben raised earlier, I don't think the big inequality issues in our society have to do with public sector workers, you know, commanding a massive portion of the pie that puts them in the 1% versus the 99%, to take the language of the Occupy movement. So to speak to the caller, there's some misinformation out there as well.
We just have about 5 minutes left. Some other callers here. I hope the caller will forgive me for going on. Next is Kankakee, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was hoping you'd talk about the Boeing case, in which Boeing wanted to build an aircraft assembly plant in Carolinas, relatively non-union, in order to influence their relations with their strong unions back home. And as I understand it, Labor Relations Board opposed the construction of that plant. I wonder if you can discuss whether
agency's general counsel, who acts as an independent prosecutor, brought a complaint against the Boeing company, not because they didn't want them to build in South Carolina, but because it was alleged that Boeing officials had said that they were moving to South Carolina because their employees in the state of Washington had exercised their right to strike. So the allegation was this was retaliation against the workers exercising their right to strike, which is explicitly protected in the National Labor Relations Act. The case generated a huge amount of controversy, particularly in South Carolina. It led to many battles between the agency's general counsel and various oversight committees in the Congress. The dispute, however, has been settled by Boeing and the Machinists Union. Both sides seem extremely happy with the resolution. That's the way the collective bargaining process is supposed to work. And the agency's complaint against the Boeing company has been dropped. So there will be no litigation of that case.
Real quick, we see we've got one more caller, Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'm sorry I haven't been listening, but I would like for you to reprise what's been going on with the non-filling of the NLRB and the recess appointments. But I'd have to say something about the extremely happy. In negotiations, generally, neither side is extremely happy. Most of them just, you know, most of the times people just have to settle, and that's usually the ending of. I've never heard of a labor dispute that's where both sides are extremely happy. So.
Actually, let me address that real quickly. I've done a lot of work with the UAW and Ford, and they reached a collective bargaining agreement in 2003 and in 2007 that set the stage for jointly advancing quality and safety in the workplace that was instrumental in the turnaround of the company, and company officials will tell you that. The form of collective bargaining is a highly contested terrain, but it's also a space in which the parties can pursue their mutual interests, and that's something that we need to see more of.
Maybe just for a second, and unfortunately we only have about a minute or so left, we can come back to the question of the recess appointments to the NLRB that the president made, and I'm going to come back to Ms. Lieben. I was interested in this in the sense that the very same day the president also made a recess appointment to fill the top post of the Consumer Protection Financial Protection Bureau. And that, mm-hmm. that got a fair amount of attention in the media. And now maybe I'm not reading the news closely enough, but I didn't recall seeing much of anything about the recess appointments to the NLRB. And I'm curious what you would say about the amount of attention or the lack of attention that got.
I actually thought it did get a fair amount of attention. perhaps not as much, but I think that the recess appointments in both cases were done because without them, these two agencies really could not function the way they're supposed to function. The board would have gone down to only two out of five members. We now know because of a 2010 Supreme Court decision that the board cannot issue decisions with only two members, even where they disagree. And in the case of the Consumer Finance Agency, we knew the agency couldn't proceed to issue regulations and make the statute work without a designated head. Perhaps it's gotten more attention. I guess my reading of the news was the NLRB also featured in the discussion.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, Joel, you want to add anything?
Well, I think, you know, Wilma has sat in the middle of a whirlwind of criticisms of the board in recent years because it's just begun, as she says, to be a little bit more engaged in advancing people's rights under the law. I think this hour has been a good hour to begin to put these issues on the table. And the real challenge, I believe a challenge for the nation, is not just how to make the law work, which people are trying to do, as Wilma tried to do in her leadership, but to ask, where do we want to go from here as a nation?
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for the moment. I'm sure we'll come back to many of these issues, but for this hour, we'll have to close things out with our thanks to Wilma Liebman. She's the former chair of the National Labor Relations Board. Ms. Liebman, thank you very much for talking with us.
And thank you so much for having us.
And here in studio, Joel Kutcher-Groschenfeld. He's the professor and a dean in the School of Labor and Employment Relations here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thanks.
A pleasure.